Mr. Otis Harris and wife.
All right, what was your job within the company?
I was a chairman on that hospital here.
Can you force strike against the strike?
Oh, I was against the strike.
Were you part of the, were you a member of the company's, yeah, the company's union?
Well, I remember the company had no union at all. It didn't have no union. No, the company had no union.
But you were not a member of the one that was the union. The company didn't have you doing their company.
Well, what happened is that the Amalgamated Steel was trying to organize business steel values. And most of the men didn't. It was just about a dozen people that shut that steel mill down, stopped 1,300 people from working. It wasn't over a dozen.
You came over from Newton with the steel company.
Right? I come with the steel mill from the Chicago.
Was there a lot of people?
On the transfer.
Was there a lot of people that came over? There's a lot of people that came over when you
were there. There was quite a few people that came. There was mostly young people that wasn't married, only the bosses and things like that. Some of them were.
What would you say was like the percentage of the workers that were that came over, that came with Newton Steel from where, when it came to Monroe? Understand?
About how many? What percent do you think came with the steel mill?
With
the steel mill?
Oh, well, it's. I imagine 50% of the people come from Newton Falls to work in that mill. Because those were the very few people when we started up down there that was from town. So there was a lot of people from Newton Falls in Stanford up here.
Well, what was it like working in the mill? The wages, the hours, and the working conditions?
The working conditions, well, the working conditions was all right. We had no trouble with the company at all. And, of course, we worked shifts. There were three shifts because it continued when the milk got hot, you know, they had to keep going. So the only time we shut down would be over the weekend. And at that time, they changed the rules to another week.
Part of the mill even worked over the weekend, didn't they? The finishing department, some of them had...
The hot mill would work, but see, I was on the shears, and we had to finish up what the hot mill rolled out. We had to shear that and get it to the finishing department over the weekend. I always worked on...
You always worked on
the weekend? Yeah, I always worked on the weekend. Because we had to finish up that stuff, the hot mill rolled out and get it to the finishing department.
What were the What was the basic identity of the workers, like their ethnic group, their religion, their political association?
A lot of them were Welsh people that came to meet in Falls.
Oh yeah, there's quite a few Welsh people, but there was a lot of, I think it Yugoslavs.
Yeah.
Like Mike, you remember Mike Andrico and
Tony
Hauser and Joe. They were all you. I think you might call them
Yugoslavs. Well, I think they called them Serbians then. Now I don't know whether there were quite a few blacks, but not a whole lot to
deal
with.
The black people at that time had the dirty people. They had them on the bar shears and the picklers, and that's where the colored guys were. And they never complained. At that time, they didn't, I guess maybe they wasn't supposed to. But that's the job of the colored people did at that time. Yeah, they worked in the pictures.
All right, you said that you weren't in favor of the strike, but could you tell me why they striked anyway? Why this dozen people strike? Do you have any idea?
The men that went on strike because they wanted the company to recognize.
They wanted to recognize that
amalgamated steel.
That's the name of it at that time. And then it come to SWOC, I think, after
steel
that.
Steel workers, something or other. They finally did get organized.
Well, no, they never did. They never organized Republic Steel.
Republic Steel.
But they kind of helped out because the big shot down there that he worked with me was the organizer down here at the plant. He ain't on this thing at all. He took part of my job. Of course, he took part of some of the other guys' jobs too, because he had 8 children, and he had the idea. He had 8 children. I had none. He should have my job, see, because it was best. And he was from town here. He didn't come up.
Was that Loveland?
Yes, sir. Ralph Loveland. Yep.
They both ran
into
the friend.
And I tell you, when I went to the stoker, Ralph was still organizing for the International Union. And they got the idea that, well, that amalgamated was communist. That was mostly communist. And he was asked to sign an affidavit, and he had nothing to do with the communists, he couldn't do it. And he lost that job of organizing, and he couldn't get a job in Monroe after that, so he started, I think, a window washing business and rug cleaning and things like that on his own, because he couldn't get the job. He was on the blacklist.
Could you describe how the picket line was broken?
Okay.
How the picket line was broken.
Well, it's the city that broke the picket line. They were down there with the police and gas and tear gas and And they broke their picket line for us to go see. Of course, we were all there. We were just waiting for them to do that. So when they scattered those guys, why, a bunch of companies steal me on and a bunch that was waiting to go to work went in there and dumped the cars in the river, and away we went.
Mr. Nag was mayor at the time, and he was with him. He worked it real hard. I mean, he wanted to help get the men back to work.
But see, that all three ships went to work on that day. And they had that whole bunch down there, and some of them with guns. And they just stood guard, the ones that wasn't working. Of course, I was fortunate. I went to work and I started shearing the iron that was left there before the strike ceased. So I didn't go out on the vigilantes, you might call them. But what made the strike so bad is the. Fussed up the UAW, United Auto Workers, up in Detroit. And they come down here the Sunday after the picket line was built at a mass meeting out at the state park in Eddingsville Park, where they fought it. And of course we had to guide the plant and along the lake and along the swamp out there, and we had everybody out there. Even guys with a shotgun that never even had a gun in their hand before. And as far as I know, there was only one shot fired. And that was down there by the paper mill. Those people that lived alongside the road there by the river. One of those guys was going home and being stopped. And he got fired at it. He was all right because he lived there, see. But he should have stopped and told him who he was, but he didn't. So that was the only shot I knew in this fire.
Who was sheriff at that time? Was that sheriff? Sheriff of Monroe County.
Sheriff, let's see. The sheriff was Barley.
Was it Barley?
Barley,
I believe.
I don't remember his name. Best Fisher, he was the Monroe. He was the chief of police. Joe Barley was the sheriff.
Yeah.
Yep, that's right, it is bad. But see, Jess Fisher, when we opened up that steel mill, he was the guard down there. He stayed down there in that shanty and looked at their badge and let us go through. And after that, he got to be chief of police. And he was chief of police during the strike, I believe, John Norris. So that all helped us. And of course, that strike, the city was for it. The whole city was on our side.
Against the strike itself,
And I don't think it helped it. Hurt anybody at all, because at that time Nags was the mayor of Monroe, and it wasn't very long until he was up at Lansing, or the governor of Michigan, and that all that helped him too. And Mayor Nag had that store, the grocery. And he carried a lot of the boys that wasn't getting along very good. He carried them on the charge account.
Okay, you just said that the whole Monroe was in favor of the... You just said that all of Monroe was in favor of the strike.
I don't know of anybody in Monroe that was only what was...
They were the strike, but not for the union. They were...
Oh, no.
Excuse me, I said it wrong. They were in favor of you.
And there was no unions in town. There was no union
at that
time.
They were in favor of getting them back to work.
The only union that I know of, well, old John L. Lewis had the United Mine Workers, and UAW was just getting started. Yeah.
All right, could you give me some examples, like how people help the steel workers go back to work who weren't even really connected with the steel strike?
You want to know if you can tell how the people helped for you people to go back to work that didn't work there or anything? It was the city people who did things to get you back there.
Oh yeah, sure. A lot of people did things to get us back.
Do you know what some of them were?
Well, I really don't know, but it was just a couple of days before we broke that picket line. We had a big meeting at the high school, all the steel workers. And there was a woman there. She'd get up there and give us a speech, and she just begged us, told us to go back to work and everything. We were going to have lots of help. And the city was with us, and the police and everybody was with us.
You don't know who that was.
I don't remember who that was, but boy, she really gave us speech.
But she was not connected with the mill. She was from the city.
She was from that city here somewhere. She got up there and she just told us boys to get down there and go to work. But the guy that done the most pushing for us boys was Ivory Powell. He worked hard to get it. And he was that organizer, that colored guy, that was the organizer down there. They caught him coming out of the post office and beat him up right in front of the post office.
What a business. What was his name, you know?
Who's that?
The colored man.
It's Donner.
I thought there was somebody else.
He had some funny first name, but his name was Donner. He was colored. And
he came from Toledo, I think, didn't he?
I don't know. He's either from Toledo or Detroit. But he was going home, and they caught him again out there on Dunbar Road just before. Side telegraph road to beat him up again. But when they beat him up in front of the post office, that was kept kind of quiet because that was not the federal offense. I knew he did it, and I never told anybody, and I never will.
Okay, after you broke through the line, you broke through the picket line and everything, what happened after you broke through the picket line, like the next day and so on?
The next day and things?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we went back to work on our regular shift, of course, and we had no trouble down there afterwards. Those guys in the picket line, you didn't come back to work. They came back and we had no trouble after that.
Was there any hostile feelings towards them when they came back to work? Or anybody, was anyone mad at them when they came back to work?
Well, of course he was mad, but we didn't let on. He just went on to work and did things he always did. Of course there was a little friction there, but it didn't show up.
Could you describe some of the events that led up to the strike?
What led up to it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I didn't even know there was going to be a strike until they just got down there and stopped us from doing it. I was never even asked to join the union. So there's very few people get that chance now.
What kind of impact did you think the strike had on the city?
What kind of an impact do you think the strike had on the city?
Well, I really didn't say that. I don't think it had a whole lot of impact on the city. But the city, the people was good to us boys who come up here. The rest of it, I did, and I roomed down on First Street. And we'd go up there to Midway Music Box, you remember that? Well, and those Gilson and Spillies, they were on the restaurant down below.
Yeah.
Or that they were so good to us. They'd even put extra stuff on the table when we in there. Yeah, they were good friends. And in 1930, when I come back up here, it was 31, when I was back to the other time, I boarded and moved out on a Pleasant Road. It's still in town. With the buses. Do you remember the buses?
I remember them, you know.
Did you know? $8 a week. All we paid, and boy, did she feed it. All we could eat. And that's what it was. That's what I paid, is $8 a week.
When they ran out of money,
we got our room and board. And when we got out of money, we even poured money out of her to go to an expedient. So the people of Monroe were really good to us. In those days, you know, it was prohibition. You couldn't buy liquor in time. You had to go to a speakeasy and tap on the door, and they'd peek out through there, and they knew you got in. If you didn't know you didn't. That's the best of prohibition. But during the strike, you know, we had beer, near beer, you call it.
Yeah.
At that time, during the strike, because when he was about within 32, prohibition was all over him. But when in 30 and 31, when we come up here, you can buy it here. There was no beer gardens or nothing else. But boy, after the Roosevelt opened that thing up, there was a lot of beer gardens in town. The old Walk Garden, Wonder Bar, and there's one out on Telegraph Road, and I don't know what else.
Take out what you don't want in there.
No, just give it all to me.
No, that is just a few people that set the studio down. And the studio was in bad shape. What happened to this Newton Steel down there? They built that steel mill just at the wrong time. Things were changing so fast that the strip mills come in before they even got that and built. And they were building the most modern plant in the country. But before they got it built, you might say it was obsolete because it's strip mills coming right behind us. Like, just at the time that they went to open this thing, the strip mills come in. And that's what made it bad for the Newton Steel Company. The Newton Steel Company, they were a big company. They really were.
How long did Newton Steel really operate?
Well, Newton Steel was in Newton Falls there, I imagine, probably about World War I, about 1918, I imagine it started down there.
How long did they operate in the world?
How long? The
steel mill. How long?
How long did they operate?
Here.
Well, let's see. I worked one day in 1938. But the hot mill was shut down at that time. They were shipping stuff in here for the finishing department to finish, but the hot mill was down. So I worked up in the finishing department at the hot mill shut down. And I worked one day in 1938. And some of the rest of them worked longer than that. I don't know how long. But I think probably they might have worked right up until the time of it. See, the government took the steel mill off of the Republic and gave it to Alcoa during the war. So that ended the steel mill business.
Could you describe the mill, some of the changes that have happened in Monroe since then? Like, what was the city like during this time?
What changes have been made since then? What was the city like then? And
what changed
a lot?
Changes at the mill?
Well, the whole city as a whole.
That's in the city of Monroe.
Oh, in the city of Monroe.
Life is frozen.
Of course, the plant down there changed hands from Alcoa.
After
Alcoa had it, who was
Alcoa
next?
Had it. They had that Garrington place out there. Remember that? The housing place out there. And then after the war, Chelsea Hayes got a hold of it. And then after Chelsea Hayes got a hold of it, Ford took it over.
Lots of changes when you first think about them, but they come gradually to live them, and you just kind of forget about
them. Yeah, well,
why you live in
the steel mill. Yeah. Of course, the steel mill was, it was there, and then they just changed the hands, during the war.
We only lived in, right in Monroe for about 5 years. We lived at Gulfstream. We lived out there, and then we moved down to Hubble Street. We lived about 5.5 years on Hubble Street, and then we moved out here. So
Get ready and the whole bunch of them go along.